Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Friday, the 29th of November, these are our main stories. President Trump has made his first visit to Afghanistan, announcing he's restarted peace talks with the Taliban. A bitter row has broken out between France and Turkey over Syria, just days before the two NATO states attend the 70th anniversary summit of the alliance. And the British police commander, on the day of the Hillsborough football disaster 30 years ago, has been cleared over the deaths of 95 fans. Also in this podcast,
to get sort of almost blizzard conditions like this, even in places like Minneapolis and Denver, and Denver's very high up.
A typical weather forecast on BBC television, what could possibly go wrong? Find out later. President Trump has made an unannounced visit to Afghanistan, where he visited US troops as they celebrated the Thanksgiving holiday. After arriving at Bagram Airfield, Mr. Trump told them that he believes the Taliban are open to a ceasefire.
The Taliban wants to make a deal. We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see. But they want to make a deal. And they only want to make a deal because you're doing a great job. That's the only reason they want to make a deal. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank the Afghan soldiers for really, I've spoken to a lot of you today, and you say they're really fighting hard. I was very impressed with that, actually, so I want to thank you.
It's Mr. Trump's first visit to the country as president. Our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler, assessed the president's visit to Afghanistan.
Donald Trump landed in Afghanistan on a trip surrounded by secrecy and a huge amount of security. The White House said the visit was intended to show support for soldiers during America's Thanksgiving holiday, when they were thousands of miles away from their families. But while officials insisted the trip was not connected to peace talks with the Taliban, President Trump did confirm that the US had restarted negotiations after they collapsed in September. A week ago, Afghanistan freed three Taliban members as part of a prisoner swap for two Western academics. And Mr. Trump stated that he believed the group wanted to make a deal. The US president also met Afghanistan's leader, President Ashraf Ghani, during what was his second visit to an active conflict zone since taking office. Last Christmas, he flew to Iraq, and during this trip, he served food to some of the soldiers before sitting down to eat a traditional Thanksgiving dinner with them. Mr. Trump praised their service, but he again emphasized his desire to remove troops from the Middle East. He said that the US would be substantially reducing its presence in Afghanistan, although he didn't give numbers or details.
That was our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler. A row has broken out between two key NATO allies, France and Turkey, over policy on Syria. At a joint news conference in Paris with the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, the French President Emmanuel Macron warned Turkey it couldn't expect solidarity after launching its Syrian offensive without consulting allies.
I respect the security interests of our Turkish ally, who has suffered many terrorist attacks on its soil. But one cannot, on the one hand, say that we are allies and with respect to this demand our solidarity, and on the other hand, put its allies in the face of a military offensive done as a fait accompli, which endangers the action of the coalition against Islamic State, which NATO is part of.
In Ankara, the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Mr. Macron had backed Kurdish fighters whom Turkey considers to be terrorists.
He is already the sponsor of the terrorist organisation and constantly hosts them at the Elysee. If he says his ally is the terrorist organisation, we have an answer for this, but there is really nothing more to say. Macron cannot be the leader of Europe with shifting attitudes. Right now, there is a void in Europe.
Our defence and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, has been following developments.
Coming just a few days before a very brief NATO summit that's going to be held in Britain early next week, It's clearly the last thing that the NATO alliance wants. I think, though, it does underscore, on the one hand, both how the events in northeastern Syria are straining relations within NATO. Mr. Macron, the French president, has been critical both of the American unilateral decision to pull back its support for the Kurds and then the unilateral Turkish decision to launch this offensive into Syria. Both decisions, he points out, that were made by individual governments, which have huge strategic consequences, which were not shared or discussed with the NATO alliance as a whole. But the second thing it shows, I think, is the really slow drift of what many people see of Turkey away from NATO and the West. Remember, this is the same Turkey that is now putting into service, or it's certainly in the latter stages of training with a brand new Russian surface-to-air missile system. You know, an extraordinary purchase for a NATO ally.
So what does this tell us about the state of the alliance?
Well, I think the problem is this, that it's an alliance which is obviously now 70 years old. Its advocates tell you that it's the most successful military alliance in history. And I mean, there's nothing comparable that has had that longevity. It's succeeded in having a remarkable long life. Yes, of course, NATO is relevant for its members today, not least because many see a resurgent Russia, which, whilst it's not posing the same threat as the Soviet Union of old, certainly is trying to cause a trouble, as many Western countries would see it. The difficulty, of course, is that today NATO is so much larger. It has to deal with very different perceptions among many of its members. You have countries like the Baltic Republics and Poland, for whom Russia is the really only issue. You have countries on the Mediterranean flank of the alliance, Italy, southern France, of course, people there have the same concerns. And of course, a country like Turkey on the eastern flank of the alliance has a very particular perception as well. It's worried about the chaos in the Middle East, nearest to it, in Syria, and of course, its own very much domestic problem with the Kurds. And that's the difficulty, I think, for the alliance. It's very much larger now, and it's having to contend with a much greater variety of threats and different perceptions as to the importance of those individual threats among different members.
That was Jonathan Marcus. An Iraqi military commander who was sent to the southern city of Nasiriyah has been sacked after the security forces there killed at least 25 anti-government protesters. The Prime Minister, Adel Abdel Mahdi, withdrew the commander hours after he had been dispatched to the city to restore order. Early on Thursday morning, the authorities opened fire as they cleared demonstrators from a bridge. This Iraqi man, Ahmed, sent the BBC a WhatsApp message from a nearby bridge and described what he saw.
As we speak, I see the ambulance taking the injured. The situation is on high alert. And Nasiriyah is calling out for help. They started attacking at 3 a.m. today. Everyone was asleep and the demonstrators were few. First, they came to the Olive Bridge and they started arresting the demonstrators indiscriminately and firing live bullets at them. Until this minute, people are still dying and getting injured. All our hospitals, private and public, are overwhelmed with the injured. Until this minute, we're still sending people to the hospital. If God wills, we will rise from this. We hope we will actually get rid of this corrupt group who are killing our wives and children, wasting their future and taking Iraq into the abyss.
Clashes continued through the day and a security force headquarters was set ablaze. Altogether, another seven demonstrators were killed in more unrest elsewhere in Iraq. The protesters, who want to sweep away the entire political system, have been on the streets for nearly 2 months. Laith Kuber is an independent advisor to the Iraqi Prime Minister and the government. He's currently in London, having left Baghdad on Wednesday. James Menendez asked him if the government had been too heavy-handed in the way it tried to quell the protesters and the violence.
I think it's been blind-handed rather than simply heavy-handed, because it could have been much worse in terms of violence. And I think, to the Prime Minister's credit, he's been stopping some of the tendencies of several agencies who wanted to be more repressive and more violent.
And yet many people have lost their lives.
Absolutely. That's the reason I call it's being blind-handed. It's not knowing the nature of the challenge and not knowing how to respond to it. So it was the whole package of response to the protesters indicates to me clearly that they haven't grasped what this issue is all about, what it's all about. They haven't got it. They haven't realized what's driving the protesters, who are they, and that the last thing you do is to use violence against them, the very last thing you do. So the fact that...
Because it can inflame things even more.
Absolutely. And because once you start that path, you cannot go back. And that's what I believe happened. That now we're in a vicious cycle that's going to bleed. And it's all we can do is try to control the damage and pave a future alternative course. But what started cannot be reversed back. And I think it's an illusion to throw jobs or money and promises and to think, or even bullets, and to think you can put it down.
The trouble is the message from the protesters seems to be that they wanted a clear out of the entire political class and indeed political system, because they say that that's the only way to get rid of corruption. And in a way, how can the government respond to that apart from stepping aside?
Well, the articulation of the protesters' demand, sometimes they go into, let's say, a wish list or a dream list.
But essentially, it's that the system is rotten and it's not serving them.
Absolutely. But the core of the message is that we no longer trust that the system can deliver. We no longer trust that the system can fix itself. We would like to see a fresh start that we believe in and we can trust. Now, the response of the government so far has been, I can do this for you. And they're not getting it, that they're not trusting the government in that. A better course would be, let's create a phase, a transition phase, with a transition body. And let's work through that transition phase and body to try to put things back into a meaningful package. This hasn't taken place yet.
But how do you deal with corruption, though, when it is systemic? And there are so many vested interests who have no reason to step aside.
In my view, there has been one or two occasions in the past 10 years where not only public protest, but the Najaf, the senior clergy, and other public figures have all aligned themselves, giving the prime minister at that time, be it Abadi or be it Sayyid Adel, giving them the opportunity to pick a fight with those corrupt political parties. They didn't do it because I think, as politicians, in their calculus, it's not sustainable. But the longer you delay it, the more problematic it become. And now the demands of the protesters, if you cannot do it despite elections and despite our protests, then the system is certainly not working.
That was Laith Kuba, an independent advisor to the Prime Minister and government of Iraq. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it's repatriated nearly 130 Yemeni rebels who've been prisoners of war in Saudi Arabia. It's a step forwards in attempts to end the conflict in Yemen between the Saudi-led coalition and Houthi rebels. Here's Imogen Folks.
The return of detainees is seen as a key factor in the slow and complex process of ending Yemen's conflict. Today's repatriation, the ICRC said, was excellent news for the detainees and for their families in Yemen, with whom they could now be reunited. Earlier this week, the Saudi-led coalition signalled it was ready to release 200 prisoners it said were members of the Houthi rebel group. The Saudis also said they were ready to allow gravely injured people to be flown out of Sana'a airport for medical treatment.
That was Imogen Folks. Now, if you're in the United States and listening to this podcast, you are probably recovering from the festivities of Thanksgiving. Many cooks took days preparing the traditional meal, with turkey usually the centerpiece. And many Americans around the world have also been partaking of the feast. And that included the BBC's Victoria Craig. She met one London butcher who had a very busy time this week taking orders for the quintessentially Thanksgiving fare: turkey, as well as pumpkin pie and cranberry sauce.
My name is Danny Lydgate. I'm the managing director of Lydgate's Butchers in Holland Park. We've always been quite close to the US Embassy, so we've always had quite a lot of US customers. About 30 years now we've been doing American Thanksgiving. We make our own pumpkin pies made from organic pumpkins. We use really good free-range bronze turkeys. We do a range of stuffings and sausages, everything. Apple cakes, pecan pies.
You're making my mouth water, Danny. So you said you're close to the embassy, but what made you start to offer it in the beginning?
It was really a request from a customer, and then I think about 30 years ago, we really started seeing a lot of American customers in Kensington, especially. It seemed like an obvious thing for us to do.
So how much do you sell every Thanksgiving?
Well, we sell a fair few hundred turkeys, which is quite good for an English butcher. We sell probably in the hundreds of pumpkin pies as well. They're pretty famous.
So the Thanksgiving dinner that we Americans are very used to is a lot like the Christmas dinner that many British people enjoy. So when you're talking about the supply chain and thinking about turkeys that you're going to need for the end of the year, does offering Thanksgiving turkeys take away at all from your Christmas business, or have you figured out a way to balance
it out? No. What we actually find quite often is Americans who have been in London for a long time tend to celebrate Thanksgiving, but they also celebrate Christmas. Quite often in this area as well, people have more than one Christmas party, so they may even have an early Christmas and then go back to the States for Christmas. So I think actually it's part of the festive season.
Do you notice that British people are now catching on to the Thanksgiving tradition?
I think they are. I think it's another thing to celebrate, and I think it's a good thing. I think a lot more London pubs now are offering different meals for Thanksgiving. Pumpkin pie has definitely become more welcomed in London especially, and I think it's a good thing.
So what is the most popular thing you sell around Thanksgiving?
Funnily enough, we do a pecan pie, which is really, really popular.
It looks really good. I can see it over here in the case.
It's glazed. It looks amazing, and it's so popular. And we generally sell out of those. It's really good.
It might rival my mom's chocolate pecan pie, but don't tell her. Danny Lydgate, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That report by Victoria Craig, who is probably by now recovering from her Thanksgiving feast in London. Still to come in this podcast.
The smoke can travel all those hundreds of miles. It can get up into the mountains, and then it does land on these glaciers.
A new study has warned that fires in the Amazon may be directly speeding up the melting of glaciers in the Andes. Now, over the last few days on the podcast, we have been reporting about the doctors' strike in Zimbabwe and what some of them are calling a silent genocide taking place in the country's hospitals. Now the United Nations has warned that the country is on the brink of man-made starvation. On a visit to Zimbabwe, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights to Food, Hilal Elver, said nearly 8 million people, or 60% of the population, were unable to feed themselves properly.
These are shocking figures. Women and children were bearing the brunt of the crisis severely. The majority of the children I met stunted or and underweight. Child deaths from severe malnutrition have been rising in the past few months. 90% of Zimbabwean children aged 6 months or 0 to 2 years are not consuming the minimum acceptable diet.
So how did this happen? A question for our correspondent Shingai Nyoka in the capital Harare.
According to the UN, this is a combination of factors, including the worst drought that we've seen in the last 40 years or so. But they also say that it's self-made in the sense that there's certain policies that government has implemented that have contributed to the economic crisis that has worsened access to food and production of food. So what they say essentially is that the prices are rising, and even among the middle class, they can no longer afford to pay some of the high prices that we've seen. And Zimbabwe is going through an economic crisis, the worst in a decade or so, and inflation currently stands at about 490%. And so a lot of people are struggling to buy food to eat. And even in the rural areas where, as a result of the drought, the harvest has failed.
Yesterday, we were hearing from you, Shingai, about the problems that the health system is having, the striking doctors, the doctors saying that they haven't got enough equipment to look after sick people. Today, we're hearing about the possibility of man-made starvation. Is the economy actually collapsing at this point, or is this something that the government can do something to pull back?
Well, I think that's the word that has been thrown around a lot, that the economy is sinking, and there really are very few indicators that it is improving. What the government has said is that this year they implemented austerity measures, removed some of the subsidies, and so they say that they anticipated it, that these are some of the shocks that they had planned would happen as they try to turn around the economy. And just to give you an indication of what that looks like, a loaf of bread that cost $2 in January now costs 17 local dollars. The price of fuel has gone up by almost the same kind of rate. And so it is a shock to a lot of Zimbabweans, and many of them are falling through the cracks. According to this report, most people are eating one meal a day. That's all that they can afford. But the government says that next year things should improve and that the economy is turning around. But many people are yet to see that on the ground.
That was Shinganyoka in Harare. The tragedy at the Hillsborough football ground in 1989 was Britain's worst sporting disaster. On Thursday, a retired British police commander was found not guilty of the gross negligence manslaughter of 95 Liverpool football fans who died after being crushed at the FA Cup semi-final there. David Duckenfield, a former South Yorkshire police chief superintendent, was cleared after a seven-week retrial. A jury rejected the prosecution's argument that Mr. Duckenfield bore personal responsibility for what happened. Relatives of the victims have said they're shocked and stunned by the verdict. Our correspondent Judith Moritz was in court.
David Duckenfield has now stood trial three times. The first two juries in Leeds 19 years ago and in Preston earlier this year were unable to reach verdicts. Now, at the third time of asking, a jury has found he was not responsible and was unfairly singled out for prosecution. His acquittal is the latest twist in the history of a disaster which has lasted 30 years. For all that time, the families of those who died and the survivors of the crush have campaigned for justice and accountability. Outside the court, Chrissy Berg, who lost her father at Hillsborough in 1989, expressed her anger at the verdict.
We've challenged everything we could possibly challenge, but it's not our trial. I've sat in this courtroom with these families for 2 years, and I've never known a trial where prosecution counsel doesn't object to one single thing in the courtroom. And that speaks volumes for itself, the way the trial was going and what the outcome was going to be.
David Duckenfield was charged with the gross negligence manslaughter of 95 Liverpool fans at the FA Cup semi-final in Sheffield in 1989. Legally, the 96th victim, Tony Bland, could not be included in the prosecution, as he died nearly 4 years later. Mr. Duckenfield did not dispute that he ordered the opening of a gate at Hillsborough to let fans in, or that he failed to close the tunnel to the terraces, which were already full. But his defence argued that he didn't breach his duty and had been a target of blame for the disaster. After today's verdict, Margaret Aspinall from the Hillsborough Family Support Group said it was a disgrace that no one had been found accountable.
How can 96 be unlawfully killed and no one be accountable? Please give us the answer who unlawfully killed my son along with 95 others.
Operation Resolve, the criminal inquiry that led to the trial, lasted 7 years and cost nearly £70 million. Its head, Rob Beckley, gave his reaction to the verdict.
When all the Hillsborough legal proceedings are concluded, we should, as a society, take time to consider these matters and to learn those lessons for the sake of the 96 innocent people who died 30 years ago. Something like this disaster and the 30-year wait to get to this point should never happen again.
David Duckenfield will now be able to resume his life in retirement on the South Coast. 30 years after Britain's worst sports disaster, no one who was in authority that day has been convicted for so many lives lost.
Judith Moritz reporting. The tropical glaciers in the Andes are a crucial water resource for millions of people in South America. Now, for the first time, researchers have shown that the glaciers are melting at an accelerated pace due to extensive burning in the Amazon rainforest. It means these precious water reservoirs, already under threat from climate change, could be in even greater danger. Our science correspondent is Victoria Gill.
So essentially, Jackie, this is like a big forecasting model. So the scientists have looked at two particular years. I mean, a lot of us will have seen the headlines this year about thousands of fires in the Amazon rainforest. But actually, interestingly, this year wasn't quite as bad as 2007 and 2010, which are the 2 years that these scientists looked at. And the reason that they wanted to look back into the past was because they wanted the entire model of exactly what happened when this smoke travelled, where it travelled to and what effect it had, and then to measure the impacts on glaciers after that. So they've used an array of different atmospheric models to forecast and show that actually, yes, the smoke can travel all those hundreds of miles, it can get up into the mountains, and then it does land on these glaciers. And then when they've looked at these models, they've shown that the impact that that smoke, those smoky particles can have, is that it can darken those glaciers to such a degree that although it's not very visible, it has an impact on the melt rate, because they're essentially getting darker and reflecting less of the sun's energy. So they melt faster. And they can show this by looking at, there's some quite clever technology aboard certain satellites that are looking particularly at atmospheric models and at what's in the chemicals in smoke and in clouds, and they can actually tell apart smoke from clouds and black carbon in that smoke. So they can back up what they've modelled with the measurements from these satellite images and show that, yes, this smoke does travel to these mountain glaciers, and when it lands there, it darkens their surface, and that does seem to be accelerating the melt rate.
Now, these glaciers are a water resource, a vital water resource for lots and lots of people in South America. So what sort of impact is this having?
Yeah, that is exactly right. So that's the worry, because at the moment the impact is unknown, but there's already a threat to those tropical Andean glaciers. And in fact, this particular result wasn't a surprise to these scientists, because they've actually seen similar effects happening in the Himalayas and in the Arctic. But in the Andes in particular, millions of people, right from the mountains to the coast, rely on these seasonal meltwaters. And it's this sort of compound effect in that part of the world, because those glaciers are already under threat from climate change. The models for climate change, the projections for climate change from the IPCC suggest that the Amazon basin is going to get drier, that there'll be more drought in that area, making that meltwater more important, but also accelerating this melt rate. So you've got this sort of toxic cocktail, and this is just another addition to that cocktail that means that those meltwater supplies are under threat.
That was Victoria Gill, our science correspondent. Now picture the scene. You've ordered a new sofa, it arrives with the delivery drivers, but it just won't fit through the door. A frustrating situation that many of us can relate to, and now so can the Irish Parliament, although theirs involves not a sofa, but a giant printer. It's landed Parliament officials at the centre of a controversy. An inquiry's taken place into how staff managed to spend more than $1 million in total so far on a state-of-the-art printer that was too big to fit into the building. Fiacra O'Kionna is a journalist at Ireland's national broadcaster RTE. He's been covering this story and he told me more.
So as part of an upgrading of the Irish Parliament, officials decided last year to purchase a state-of-the-art industrial-scale printer for the campus. Internal emails that were released at the weekend show officials signed off on the Komori printer, which is only one of two in the entire country in Ireland, last autumn. However, when the printer arrived on December 5th last year, it came with two qualifiers. One, it cost €808,000, and two, it wouldn't fit in the building. When the printer was eventually installed on September 28 this year, it needed just under €250,000 of structural work, so that includes tearing down walls, to fit it into the building. And to make matters worse, most politicians have yet to use it. A workers' union in the Irish Parliament has said its members will not touch it until they're giving proper training. And at a meeting today in Parliament, it emerged the cost, including taxes, of the printer is now €1.6 million.
On one level, it's very funny, and on another, it's such an eye-watering sum of money that seems to have been wasted. What sort of reaction has there been?
Well, the reaction has been exactly what you said. It's been one part anger in terms of the amount of money spent and one part sheer comedy. In terms of the anger, it's pretty obvious as to why. This is seen as yet another in a long line of cases where public money has been spent for questionable reasons and at a time when there's a housing crisis and a homelessness crisis in Ireland. The clerk of the Dáil, so Irish Parliament's most senior civil servant, his name is Peter Finnegan, and he has also launched and completed a report this week on the matter. Now, on the comedy part, there's a pretty obvious thing here. If people buy, for example, a couch for their own built for their own home, of course you get the measuring tape out and you check that it will actually fit in the room before you buy it. This doesn't seem to have been done properly in this case. Secondly, the situation hasn't been helped by a photo going around social media in the last couple of days of the million euro plus printer, in which a Parliament worker has placed their wet clothes hanging next to the printer, seemingly unaware of its cost. Really, at this point, the people involved are probably, if not swimming in printer ink, they're certainly swimming in questions about it.
The RTE journalist Fiacra O'Connor. Now, as you can imagine, here at the BBC, our radio and TV programmes are meticulously prepared for our audiences, both at home and around the world. But sometimes, just sometimes, things don't go as planned. On Thursday, the BBC weather presenter Thomas Schaffernacker was giving his forecast live on the news television channel when he fell foul of so-called voice-activated technology. Or I should say, his watch on his wrist. The news presenter Simon McCoy was listening in the studio as Thomas Schaffernacker, a few metres away, informed viewers of heavy snow in the United States when the device decided to intervene.
To get sort of almost blizzard conditions like this, even in places like Minneapolis and Denver, and Denver's very high up.
There's no snow in the forecast.
Oh dear. Well, that's
your watch.
That's my watch saying there's no snow in the forecast. Goodness, apologies.
Did you just trigger that?
Well, obviously it was listening to what I was saying. Apologies for that. That was not part of the plan.
A soulless automaton there with his fancy new watch. I'm kidding. That was Thomas Schaffernacker. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Kalki Kekla. I'm a Bollywood actor and, of course, a podcast presenter. And I'm back for another season of My Indian Life. For our second season, I've been traveling all over this huge country.
Everything came crashing down because this was the only thing we had left in Kashmir. I felt like I didn't belong in Delhi.
Talking to a wide range of people who all have something to say.
There is this old belief that anybody who's born with a genetic condition is a result of sin or a result of something that happened in your life in the past, and that's why there's a stigma attached to it.
All in the company of some really inspiring young Indians.
I think happiness is a mindset, not just an emotion. I can decide to be happy or I can decide to be sad.
That's Kalki presents My Indian Life from the BBC World Service.
This music is rogue. It really represents what's going on the ground level over here.
Just search for My Indian Life wherever you get your podcasts.